This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Let's start here. It should go without saying that LGBTQ plus people are just that, people. They're adults and they're teenagers, preteens, grade school kids. They have favorite foods, obsessions with music artists, stories they like to tell over and over, and insecurities, arguments with friends, worries about what their future will look like. They're figuring out their lives like everyone else. But in the realm of politics, some elected officials have turned these identities into a topic to argue about. And in states around the country, LGBTQ plus students are experiencing increasing levels of violence and hate. There's a lot to talk about on this issue, but today we focus on one piece, solutions. Coming up, we hear about the Washington Post's reporting on FBI hate crime data. But first, what is it like to be a student right now who identifies as LGBTQ plus? What challenges do they feel in their schools, from peers, teachers, and the politicians in the states where they live? And most importantly, what can adults do to help care for and support them? I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. Stay with us. We've got a lot to get into.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and t-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR.
Let's get into the conversation. Joining us from La Crescenta, California, is Eric Eubank. They're a high school student and identify as queer and non-binary. They're also a host and co-producer of I'm Feeling Queer Today. It's a podcast with the Future Perfect Project, a nonprofit that produces creative workshops and media projects for LGBTQ plus youth. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So Eric, we're meeting you for the first time today. What do you want us to know about who you are?
I mean, I think the little introduction said a lot. I definitely think that my queer identity is a big part of who I am, and also the activism that I try and do, even if it's on a smaller scale. Things like I'm Feeling Queer Today are ways that I kind of express who I am, but also what I care about, and I try and impact the world, even if it's just on a couple of people.
How would you describe what it feels like to be a teen these days, especially at school?
Definitely complicated. I think you said it best. Queer youth are struggling with all of the regular things that teenagers struggle with, whether it's figuring out their futures or just dealing with high school drama and things like that. But on top of that, it's also the fear of the fact that there are lawmakers in our country, even people that might be our neighbors, who don't only not support who we are, but just don't really tolerate it either. And even in places like California, where that's not an active threat necessarily, there's still this lingering fear and apprehension about being queer.
Many of us have heard reports about 16-year-old Nex Benedict. They died in Oklahoma last month, the day after a fight with fellow students in a school bathroom. Nex identified as non-binary, and the state medical examiner there ruled their death a suicide, but a full autopsy report is expected later this month. Eric, how do you process difficult news stories about LGBTQ plus young people?
Yeah, it's definitely hard because, of course, at times it feels like you're kind of powerless with those situations, especially when you're hearing about them after the fact. But I think that one thing that I do is, luckily, I have a large like support system at school through my school's GSA, which kind of allows me to discuss this type of issue with my peers who think about it in the same ways. And we also have advisors that are really supportive. So I think just having a group of people that can process it with you does a lot, and it goes a long way.
And the GSA is the school's Gay-Straight Alliance, correct?
Yes.
So tell me more about the types of conversations you're having with your peers right now.
Yeah, so stories like Next Benedict, we discuss kind of the nuances of those. Because, of course, on the surface, and most like pertinently, there is the level of hate and the more direct actions. We kind of delve into the fact that a lot of the times, especially when it comes to, for example, where I live in California, it's not necessarily direct hate, but more about ignorance. And because of these conversations, we try and kind of spread more awareness and just kind of be aware of our place in our communities and just kind of how we can deal with situations, even if it's not to that magnitude.
How much responsibility do you feel for trying to help people understand who you are and the experience LGBTQ plus youth are having right now? And does it feel like a responsibility or does it at times feel like a burden?
Well, it can be hard, especially because when there are so many things happening on such a large scale, like across the country and truly across the world, it feels like an individual or some random school in La Crescenta, California, it feels like we don't do that much. We don't have as huge of an impact as we would like, because, of course, every individual person would love to change the world. But I think that when it comes to the feeling of responsibility, I try and recontextualize it and look at it as if I can help one person, whether that's helping one queer youth kind of navigate being in part of the LGBTQ community as a child in America now, or if it's I can help one person just be a little more aware and a little bit more accepting, then I think that I've kind of done my job. Because as much as I would like to help everyone, I have to kind of recognize that that responsibility is kind of too big for me at this moment, but I try and do as much as I can.
Eric, I want to make sure to point out that not everything is bad or depressing for young people these days. You spend your time on a lot of things. What brings you joy or what things are you looking forward to?
I mean, I think that I'm definitely looking forward to just kind of being able to like kind of live freely in the world as someone who is out, because I definitely have the privilege to do that. And I'm excited to kind of just like explore me. But one thing that does bring me joy is, for example, podcasting on I'm Feeling Queer Today, because we delve into, of course, a lot of the like pertinent issues to the present day. But we also talk a lot about queer joy and things that we look forward to and things that are positive when it comes to being queer in America.
What's the biggest thing you've learned in doing that podcast and talking to other young people?
I mean, because it's produced and hosted by people across the country, I definitely think that the different perspectives on everything that's happening, both good and bad, has been something that's been really eye-opening, because I've gotten to interact with so many people that I never really would have talked to before. And I think I've definitely learned the fact that there can be so many different perspectives on an issue, even with such similar people.
How are you thinking about what it means to form community, both right now and as you move into adulthood?
I think community is a lot about solidarity. It's standing up for, but also standing with the people who you are forming community with. And I think right now, of course, that looks a lot different because I'm in high school and it's with other students and often a more organized setting. But I think in the future, I'm hoping that whether it's joining a community or forming one, that I can kind of see that same support that I have in my little microcosm of high school now.
And what makes you feel most supported, especially in school?
I think it's when there are not necessarily figures of authority, but just people outside of my direct community that are showing support. I think when that support and that allyship is louder than the noise expressed by the hate and the ignorance that's happening everywhere and within my community, I think that's something that makes me feel so supported.
What kinds of misconceptions or misunderstandings do you find adults and other young people have about the way of approaching identity and labels that you take?
I think misconception often comes from rigidity and kind of staunch, like, narrow perspectives of how people should act or behave or identify. And while I think that the LGBTQ community, and especially queer youth and Gen Z, are becoming a lot more fluid with how they express themselves and how they identify, I think these misconceptions come a lot from kind of narrower perspectives on those things.
I don't know that you've had a chance to sit across a table from a lawmaker in your state, but if you could, and you could have a conversation with them about what they can do to support LGBTQ plus youth, what would you tell them?
I mean, of course, California is a lot different than a lot of the other states that have more direct legislation against queer youth. But I think in general, what I would tell a lawmaker is, I mean, obviously, not to make laws that hurt queer and especially trans youth, but more like reasonably, I would definitely kind of discuss the idea that they should be using their platform as a form of activism, not necessarily through the laws they make, but what they say and how they interact with people and how they talk to the country or the state as a whole.
That's Eric Eubank. They're a high school student in California who identifies as queer and non-binary. They're also a host and co-producer of the podcast I'm Feeling Queer Today, made by the Future Perfect Project, a media nonprofit for LGBTQ plus youth. Eric, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we head to Tulsa and hear from Oklahoma's School Counselor of the Year about how she supports her students. Stay with us. We'll be back with more in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. AI may be the most important new computer technology ever, but AI needs a lot of processing speed, and that gets expensive fast. Upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. Sometimes it takes a different approach to unlock your true potential. Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format is designed to help you learn relevant skills at your own pace, so you can earn your degree on your terms and apply what you learn right away. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Let's turn now to a recent analysis by the Washington Post. According to data from the FBI, hate crimes against LGBTQ plus students in schools are going up, way up. That's the case for blue states with liberal governments and red states, which more often have restrictive laws around the rights of LGBTQ plus students, like the right to use their preferred pronouns or names, or using the school bathroom that matches their gender, or even having a teacher mention gender identity and sexual orientation in the classroom. Later in the hour, we talk to a school counselor about what schools can do to help these students. But first, let's welcome Laura Meckler. She's national education writer at The Washington Post and author of Dreamtown, Shaker Heights and the Quest for Racial Equity. Laura, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you had a big piece in the Post last week. It was co-written with Hannah Natanson and John Harden. Data from the FBI shows that reported hate crimes targeting LGBTQ plus students at schools have risen sharply in the past few years. And looking at this data, what were your biggest findings?
Well, the first finding, as you said, was just the rapid rise. We compared the period from 2015 to 2019 against 2021 and 2022. So essentially before these culture wars broke out, before the pandemic, and then the years that we have available afterwards. And overall, we found a doubling, which that was interesting in and of itself. But then we did another level of analysis where we divided the states up and compared those that had passed these laws targeting LGBTQ youth in various ways, whether it be through athletics or access to facilities like bathrooms and locker rooms, or as you said, curriculum. And we compared what did those hate crime numbers look like in those two different sets of states. And in the 28 states that had passed at least one of those laws, we found that there was a tripling of hate crimes in schools overall, and a more than quadrupling if we look just at K-12 schools. There also rose in the blue states, but just not as dramatically.
What kinds of hate crimes are being counted in this data?
Well, you know, it really depends on the state. It's basically what the local police report to the FBI. So, we're not talking about just your run-of-the-mill bullying type situation. We're talking about these are more serious situations. So we looked at some other data to try to look at what bullying looks like, but these are really the most serious cases.
Now, we're talking about percentage increases, but what are the overall number of reported cases each year?
So in 2015 to 19, there was an average of 108 per year, and that's averaged over that period. And then in 2021-22, there were 232 per year. That's national numbers.
So I think it's helpful if we can wrap our minds around what qualifies as a crime. And as you said, there's some variation from state to state, depending upon how police identify the action and what's reported to the FBI. But can you give us just sort of a stronger idea of what types of crimes we're talking about? Are these assaults? Is it speech?
Yeah, you know what? I'm not sure, to be honest, whether a speech crime could be so severe that it would be classified as a hate crime. So I don't want to say because I'm not 100% sure about that. But yeah, something like an assault for sure.
And when you looked at the states that were passing restrictive laws around the rights of LGBTQ plus students, which states had the most restrictive laws?
Well, you know, that's like a real mix. There are states like Florida and Texas that have, you know, passed all of the, we looked at three different types of laws. So there's a mix in terms of how many they've passed, and we have a map that you can look at as part of our story that shows you sort of which states have passed the most laws. But Oklahoma has passed quite a few. Florida obviously has led the way, but it isn't just limited to that. I mean, like I said, we found 28 states that had passed at least one of these, so it's pretty widespread. These laws really took off over the last couple of years in Republican-controlled states.
Now, you mentioned that you looked at two different time frames, one from 2015 to 2019, that's before COVID, and then 2021 to 2022, after many schools reopened. In that earlier time frame you looked at, states without restrictive laws or had an overall higher number of crimes reported compared to those states with more restrictive laws. And now between 2021 and 2022, with this rise in cases you've reported, that number is still higher in liberal states. How are you interpreting that data?
Yeah, I mean, and that was a point we wanted to make because first we were like, huh, what does this mean? The absolute number is higher in the liberal states. And we talked to a few people to try to understand that. And, you know, some of this is informed speculation, but the thinking is that it's probably that in those places people are more likely to report them than in the places, or more likely to be identified as having happened than in the places that are more conservative. Not that there are necessarily more hate crimes, but you know, we don't know that for sure. It could be that there are more hate crimes in the liberal areas. I'm somewhat skeptical of that, but it does make sense to me that it could be more likely to be reported.
Well, I want to bring another voice into the conversation now. Jennifer Sack is the lead school counselor at Booker T. Washington High School in Tulsa, Oklahoma. This school year, she was named Oklahoma School Counselor of the Year, and she joins us from Tulsa. Jennifer, welcome, and thanks for joining us during your spring break.
Thank you, Jen. Thanks for having me today.
Well, I know you've been listening along with us. What strikes you most about the data Laura is reporting on?
I think there's definitely some credibility to her point that in more conservative states that incidents probably do go unreported, because if people already feel like the rules are stacked against them, you kind of feel like, well, what's the point in reporting it if I already don't feel supported? So that didn't really surprised me too much, honestly.
We We got this message from Renee who says schools need to provide widespread professional development to teachers, administrators, custodians, and others working directly with students. I am raising a trans boy who's been out since age 5, and the way school staff have responded to him has absolutely interrupted his academic career. Staff needs to see gender issues as integral to building positive school cultures, and concerns about safety around gender should be treated with the utmost urgency and seriousness. My child has been to 4 different schools, plus 2 years of homeschooling because of gender-based bullying and unresponsive and uninformed staff. And Jennifer, in your work with students and possibly their families as well, what do you hear from them about how prepared staff are to address some of these issues in schools that students may be facing?
I think that varies from school to school. I mean, I happen to be in a school that has a more accepting kind of mindset and policy, particularly among the adults. But I mean, I know there are definitely many, many schools in Oklahoma where there's a much more conservative mindset. And, you know, when a kid comes to school and doesn't feel accepted or valued, that's an incredibly difficult way to enter the school day.
Laura, another thing you reported on are calls for help, and this is another big data point in your story, crisis hotlines, texting services. What did you find out about that?
Yeah, we found a sharp rise in these calls to these groups. So we talked with the Trevor Project. Their mission is to prevent suicide and to provide crisis intervention for LGBTQ youth. In fiscal year 2022, they had 230,000 calls and other efforts for support. And a year later, it had more than doubled to more than 500,000. So that's a very big increase in just 1 year for a group that's been around for a long time. A newer group called the Rainbow Youth Project, they also saw an increase from about 1,000 calls per month in 2022 to 1,400 in 2023. And they also, interestingly, at the Rainbow Youth Project, they to keep track of what the reason for the call is. And in 2023, the top reason, what was cited by 63% of their callers was anti-LGBTQ laws or rhetoric, people who are feeling insecure about that. Also, Jen, I want to just add, in the interim, I checked up on the question I didn't have a full answer to about what constitutes a hate crime. So just wanted to share with you that it really is any crime that is motivated in whole or a part based on a bias such as against sexual orientation or gender, and that it can be any sort of crime. But the most common ones are vandalism, damage, intimidation, or simple assault.
Jennifer, how are the LGBTQ plus students you see at your high school responding to news stories like Next Benedict's death or news about legislation that's passed in the state?
Well, I mean, kids are very aware of the values and beliefs that they see modeled and expressed at home. And with high school students in particular, I think that translates into the state level and the national level in terms of political climate as well. They're very aware of the messaging that they hear. And, you know, when you feel like you're being marginalized, that's a very intimidating thing. I think our high school students tend to, at my school anyway, they tend to be more outspoken, more active, more vocal in support of their LGBTQ peers and of one another. But that's not the case everywhere.
What do you think creates that atmosphere at the school?
I think the tone is always set from the top down. And so whether that's the teacher in the classroom or the principal leading the building or the superintendent at that local level, you know, we have a very supportive environment at my particular school. But the farther up the chain you go in my state, when you get to the state leadership level, the message changes drastically. And we just have kids that are very vocal about speaking out in support of their peers.
Jennifer, help us understand the effect of bullying on young people, especially if it's happening systematically.
Well, I mean, I think all you have to do is imagine your own self in a situation like that or your own child and how that would feel to enter a school, this place where you have to go every day, and knowing that you're going to be made to feel like you don't belong or you're not welcome or you're marginalized in some way or that you're not accepted. I mean, nobody wants to have to repeatedly enter an environment like that. And, you know, our job as school counselors and school professionals is to make school a welcoming and inclusive place for all students. There should be no condition on which a kid should come to school and feel like they are going to be treated that way, that they are somehow undervalued or marginalized or that they don't matter. I mean, that's a pillar of our position as professional school counselors, is that, you know, we know that when kids have a welcoming, inclusive environment where they feel safe and supported, they are less likely to be, you know, marginalized or feel harassed and abused in the first place. So it's our job as adults to create that culture for all of our kids.
Before we head to break, let's head to our voicemail box.
I think about my kid's school environment daily. I remember when he first came out as transgender, I would ask him every day if anybody had bullied him or if he had trouble in the bathroom. It is an anxious feeling that doesn't leave me the whole school day until he's home. Our high school is very understanding, but the country at this point is not.
Thanks for that message. Coming up, what support can school counselors, teachers, and family members give LGBTQ plus youth? We'll be back with more in a moment.
This message comes from Jackson. Seek clarity in retirement planning at Jackson.com. Jackson is short for Jackson Financial, Inc., Jackson National Life Insurance Company, Lansing, Michigan, and Jackson National Life Insurance Company of New York, Purchase, New York. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Integrative Therapeutics, with vitamins and supplements previously available only through practitioners, including Cortisol Manager. Unlock your best self with clinician-curated supplements from Integrative Therapeutics, now on Amazon.
Let's get back to the conversation with this message we got from one of you in New York.
I am the parent of a trans student who is a junior in high school, and my child is looking at colleges now, and we are not going to look at any colleges that are in red states or perhaps even purple states. And one of the things that we check when we look for colleges is the presence of support for LGBTQ on campus. Do they have someone whose job it is to advocate for these students? Is there a center where these students can go? And just looking around, do we see queer people? It's a real issue. And my child also won't even come out in their high school because they're too afraid.
And Laura, we alluded to this earlier because we talked about hate crimes, but beyond that, there is bullying in school. What does the data say about how often kids who identify as LGBTQ plus experience bullying when compared to kids in the rest of the population?
Well, the best data that we found on this came from a CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention survey from 2021. And it found that more than one in three gay, lesbian, and bisexual students had experienced bullying. And that was about half as high for straight students. So, you know, pretty common, one in three, and definitely higher than for straight students.
Jennifer, practically speaking, what can a school do to make it a safer and affirming place for young people who are figuring out their identity?
I think it's important to send that message at the outset so that kids know that they have allies in the building. I don't think kids should have to guess who in the building is it safe to talk to and who is it not. I think, you know, there are simple things that schools can do, whether it's, you know, something as simple as signage around your building that just says this is, you know, an LGBTQ safe community or, you know, we are allies, those kind of things. Those can do a lot to just let kids know right up front that they are in a safe space and they can talk openly with the adults at school and feel safe in doing so.
Do you always feel the freedom to do that, especially in a state that has passed laws that limit the rights of LGBTQ plus students?
It's difficult. And that, you know, as a school counselor, our number one guiding rule is to do no harm. That is the number one rule. And a lot of the principles that we lean on from the American School Counseling Association are very supportive in that our job is to support all students. Our LGBTQ students need inclusive language. They need, you know, barriers to be eliminated just like any other student. And we walk a very fine line sometimes in trying to obey law and yet still serve our kids, because they can't check that part of their identity at the door. That is who they are. And we have a lot of, you know, rhetoric in our state right now that says, no, that can't be a thing. That can't exist. And that's just simply not true. There are kids that come to school and this is a part of their identity. And so they do have to be welcomed and embraced. And to me, your value as a student is not up for negotiation coming in the door. You are here. You are a human child. You enrolled at my school. You are entitled to all the same dignity and respect and fair treatment and being embraced as a whole person, just like any of your peers should be.
We got this message from Kelly in Oklahoma, who writes, "My son is trans. Many southern state school boards are trying to do away with DEI programs that would assist in training school employees in LGBTQ plus issues." Jennifer, how often do you hear from your colleagues that they want more support in knowing how best to support these students?
We do, and it's difficult. And it's, I think adults in a state like Oklahoma are just trying to, like I said, walk that line between they want to be supportive and, but we also have to follow the law. We know we have to do that. And there's that real discrepancy sometimes between best practice and what state law might be telling you is what we have to do. I think there are a lot of adults who do have very supportive attitudes towards their students, and just do the best that they can to be outwardly supportive and to let their students know that you are welcome in this classroom and you are protected in this classroom and it's a safe space for you to be here.
Laura, what action has the U.S. Department of Education taken in response to state governments passing these laws that limit LGBTQ plus expression in school, whether it's guidance or language? What have we seen?
Well, the biggest, it sort of happens on two levels. I mean, the Office for Civil Rights does investigate individual cases. They're investigating the case of Next Benedict out of Oklahoma right now. But more broadly, they have actually proposed a new rule interpreting Title IX, which is the law barring sex discrimination. And their interpretation of Title IX makes clear that that includes discrimination on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation. So that, were that that regulation to be finalized, and we're expecting that to happen sometime this spring, it would essentially be the Department of Education saying that any of these laws that limit, for instance, use of facilities are contrary to federal law. And that would provide, you know, opportunity to challenge those laws on the basis of the federal Title IX. So as well as enforcement that the Department of Education itself does. So this is that, I would say that's the most important thing. They've been supportive, you know, in a rhetorical way, of course, as well. Secretary Miguel Cardona, the Secretary of Education, does talk about transgender students, and he does talk about these issues in a very supportive way. But I think the most concrete thing really is the rewrite of this Title IX regulation.
I want to get to some more of your messages. Beth writes, "My daughter has been out since kindergarten and has taught me that she was a girl since she was 3 years old. She's now in middle school. It's scary and I worry, especially when I hear the news of other kids who experience extreme bullying, have attempted suicide, etc. So far, we have been fortunate at school. Staff and teachers have been supportive. She's in the Gay Straight Alliance group, which meets monthly for fun activities with youth and their families. It's taken a lot of work to find and create a support system." And Jennifer, this is something we mentioned earlier. School may actually be the place where some young people feel the most accepted. How do you talk to them about creating community and navigating communities where they may find acceptance in some spaces, but not in others?
Well, and I think a lot of that goes back to some of the comments that Eric made at the beginning of your piece, talking about school being the place where they found the most acceptance. And just giving kids the space to build those kind of supportive environments for each other, whether it's through clubs and organizations or community social justice activities that they want to be a part of, and showing up for them as adults and being supportive of them when they want to take those actions. I think it's important to help them feel empowered to do that.
1A producer Michael Falero checked in with a licensed professional counselor in Tulsa. His name is Will Lamans, and he does outpatient therapy at Improving Lives Counseling. He works with families and LGBTQ plus youth. And here's what Will had to say about what parents can do to engage with their kids if they're LGBTQ plus or questioning.
When folks are taking this journey, right, a name may change or a nickname may show up, or you might have them say, like, here are my new pronouns, or here are the people that I'm attracted to. And so during that journey, those things may get updated. This isn't somebody changing their mind. It's someone having a better understanding of themselves.
And here's what Will suggests for young people who are LGBTQ+.
Have a hobby, right? Like, have a thing that you follow, because with things that you care about come people that care about it and by extension care about you. Even if it's crocheting or painting or, you know, card games or whatever, having something that you can connect to and you can have an excuse to be around other human beings, especially if you're in a place where you can't be completely honest about who you are, it's incredibly important to have ways to continue to reinforce those connections.
Jennifer, I'd love your thoughts on those suggestions from Will.
I think those are exactly great ideas, and helping parents and families learn how to navigate this, that, you know, the child is growing into themselves and who they are, and providing as much support around that as you can is critically important, and giving families language. And like he said, it's not a change. This is just, you know, your child growing into themselves and letting you know more about who they are. And that's really where I would encourage adults at the broader state level is to be willing to have that more open mindset, and just to have that growth mindset of just be willing to talk and listen to kids instead of just kind of domineering from the top down and saying, no, I don't agree that this is a thing, so therefore it can't be, and I'm going to shut it down. We need more openness. We need more open-mindedness and conversation, and trust our kids to know who they are and let them tell you who they are and trust them and go through that journey with them instead of trying to, you know, force it into some other box.
Laura, just returning to the legislative landscape, what movement, if any, are you seeing against these state bills and laws that limit LGBTQ plus expression by students and teachers?
Well, I think there are some signs that this culture war stuff may be starting to crest. And for instance, if we look at what's happened in Florida lately, Governor DeSantis actually did not get everything he wanted through the legislature that he had in previous years, which was a change. For instance, there was a bill banning rainbow flags in public buildings, and another one, requirement that trans people use the sex assigned at birth on their driver's license. These were measures that aren't particularly school specific, but they're in the similar bucket that did not pass the legislature. There recently was a settlement on the legislation that limited what teachers could say and teach about regarding gender identity and sexual orientation in school, making it clear that they can say it's about curriculum. It's not about what they say in their everyday, you know, conversations with students. And Governor DeSantis also at one point did allow that the state may have gone too far in some of the book removals that he was trying to do. I think we also see more pushback from and more organization on the part of parents on the left to serve as a countervailing force. And there was also some indication that at the last round of school board elections that there were fewer victories from the conservative sort of Moms for Liberty types. So I do think that there are some signs, but there also still is a lot of new legislation being proposed this year in the conservative state. So I would not say this is by any means over.
That's Laura Meckler. She's national education writer at The Washington Post and author of Dreamtown, Shaker Heights and the Quest for Racial Equity. Also with us, Jennifer Sack, lead school counselor at Booker T. Washington High in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Oklahoma's School Counselor of the Year. Laura, Jennifer, thanks for speaking with us. And again, if you or someone you know is struggling with mental health, the 988 Crisis Hotline is available 24/7. Call 988 to get help. Today's producer was Michael Falero. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Macmillan Audio. One of the most thought-provoking books about the Middle East, Thomas L. Friedman's From Beirut to Jerusalem, is now available as an unabridged audiobook featuring a new preface read by the author. Find it wherever audiobooks are sold. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.